I give you a silly picture a month of?
Once? Yes, you did. Definitely. You've done all kinds of mean things to me.
So the broad thing here is to try to solve the problem of time with trajectories. Of course, the problem in general relativity is very difficult. There's still a lot of technical issues there. Mathematically, different spaces don't really exist. It's all a big mess. It's been known for a while that, perhaps not wrongly known, but that exactly the same problem of time you have in a reformulation of Newtonian mechanics due to Jacobi. So the idea here is that, and let me just start and we'll see what the idea is. So, we start with Newtonian mechanics. So, there's a well-known way to eliminate time in Newtonian mechanics. So you start from a Newtonian Lagrangian, which is so Newtonian mechanics has this time parameter in it. And what's special about it is that even if there's no change in the whole universe, Newtonian mechanics will tell you that a certain amount of time has passed, even though absolutely nothing has happened. For example, no, all clocks are standing still, so there will be no evidence of the time that has lapsed. So for some people, this is sort of an epistemological defect of Newtonian mechanics. Time should be related to something you see, but in time in Newtonian theory is something more than that. Even if everything sits still, time will still pass. So they eliminate, you can eliminate time from Newtonian mechanics and get to a different theory where all passage of time has produced a change. And so let me just sketch that in the beginning. So the first thing is to define, so we eliminate time now. So step one, formulate Newtonian mechanics on extended configuration space. So, up here in Newtonian mechanics, you have a configuration space, big X like that, and you get trajectories which are parameterized with Newton's absolute time. Here you can reformulate Newtonian mechanics by introducing extended configuration space where T is a dynamic variable. And your action, they call bar here, is x prime and t prime. So prime is here derivative with respect to some lambda, some new unphysical parameter that doesn't have interpretation as t there. This will be more clear later on the inside, such a sort of wordy statement. So this new action L bar defined on extended configuration space is the old one. So if you take this Lagrangian here, I can put a dot here and dot this. Just put it in like that, and that's your new Lagrangian. And it's you just plug it in, it looks like okay. That means you use notation X. So it should have been a square here, but the whole Lagrangian is multiplied by t prime. Becomes a t there. We also assume that this guy is time independent. So
why is there t prime times v again?
Yeah.
V times t prime.
Yeah, so the whole Lagrangian is multiplied by t prime.
Of the whole, oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So this guy comes. Basically, this t prime comes because the Lagrangian is really a density, not a scalar. That's sort of the mathematical reason why one gets this t prime. So, that's our new Lagrangian. And since v doesn't depend on time, this t here, which is a dynamical variable, is a cyclic variable, which means that the Lagrangian only depends on the t prime, but not t itself. And whenever that happens, you know that there's a conserved quantity related to the cyclic variable. Right? Since v of x is independent, t, we know that for the Lagrangian equations of motion, the L bar t minus e to lambda, the L bar e prime, that has to be zero, right? But this is zero, because there's no direct t here. And we see that this guy has to be a constant because they can back like zero. Now, here you see immediately that the L bar is constant. And what constant isn't is not strange. It has to do with time translation invariance. So if we compute the L bar t prime, this is minus it's this expression here. So this constant here is naturally called minus e. Step two. So I don't know, maybe we call that star. Solve for p prime in equation star here. And without going through all the simple math here, I'm just going to state the solution looks like this, where t is defined. Step three. So this is equation squared. Defined. And you don't know. On the configuration space minus the constant times t prime. And substitute insert equation just plug in that relation in there and do all the things there, we arrive at the Jacobi's rendering. And this is defined now just on the original configuration space, but with a derivative with respect to lambda instead. And it looks like 2 kinetic term E minus B, like that.
I'm confused about it. It's trivial. You have that star equation, right?
Yeah.
If you say solve for T prime.
Yeah.
But it has also X prime in it, right? I mean, lambda's not out of it, so how can you?
I'm solving for T prime.
Then the solution will involve X prime.
Yeah, so prime is dd lambda.
Right, so when you say T, you mean D. When you say T, oh, I see, that has X prime.
Yeah. So that's not dd t here.
That's not the physical kinetic energy.
No, exactly, it's not the physical one.
It's the one with respect to the lambda prime.
Yeah. So t is sort of the kinetic energy, it's not really the physical one. Yeah. And now we have completely eliminated time. If you look at this Lagrangian here, here's an important thing. So by reparamization invariance, we mean the following. This guy LJ should be homogeneous to first degree, which means that LJ of X and lambda X prime should be to lambda L X X prime. So I can show that this condition here is equivalent by stating that, so let me write down the equations of motion first.
Big lambda is different than little lambda that you were taking.
Yeah. This is just, actually you
just
see
something
here.
Else.
Yeah. So C is just a positive constant here. So if you look at the equations of motion, you see that it looks like this. So this is the equations of motion. And this condition here states that, so you're going to have a solution space for this set of these equations of motion. So that means a solution space. So this condition here implies immediately that if you have a solution, X of lambda, so this is a member of the solution space, then also X of F of lambda is a member of the solution space. So this is what we mean by reparamization invariance, and it follows directly from this condition here.
So you also had that already after step one.
Yes. So one of the things here when you formulate the quantum mechanics in extended configuration space is that this action here is also reparamization invariant, but it contains also a T in it. Time is not eliminated. Yeah. What's nice with this thing is that you have a reparamization invariant theory with no special variable T in it. So
why is this interesting, this theory? Well, as we should see later, if you take this as a starting point, this Lagrangian, you think of this as the basic formulation of classical mechanics. If you quantize that theory, you get the problem of time, the same problem of time you have in general relativity. So this is why this theory is interesting. And also for people in theoretical mechanics, they often use this action because it's nicer for some reasons. It gives you sort of metrics and so on, configuration space, and sort of very geometrical formulation of dynamics.
So this question, I mean, isn't relativity more like the first version, because it has
this one?
Classical action does have time in it. I mean, isn't that closer analog to the Einstein equations?
We're gonna see. So everything we do now is in the Hamiltonian formulation. So of course, T here is a dynamical variable, but in general relativity, you have space-time coordinates, and this is not a dynamical variable there.
No, but G00 is a dynamical variable. It carries the time information.
Yes, yes. So I'm not sure how to answer the question.
There's actually only a very subtle difference between why that theory is not like GM. So I talked more about it. It's how the role that the boundary conditions play
so
that theory.
If you go to the, I mean, one way to answer this is that there's a really difference between this theory and general relativity is that if you look at the Hamiltonian constraint you get to, now I need to step forward in the talk, but it has this form. That's your Hamiltonian constraint, and it's linear in one momenta, but general relativity comes with something like that, some space metric here, and some three curvature, and there's some square root of g here, square root of g. And that's the Hamiltonian constraint here. So this is quadratic momenta, and this is linear here. But this regards the Hamiltonian formulation, of course, which might make like or dislike. So here, in this sense, this theory is not at all like general relativity.
I agree with that, but are you saying that that theory is more like general relativity?
Yes, so for example, if you look at what we're going to do later, the Hamiltonian constraint in that theory is just p squared plus v, basically, and this constant here is zero. That very much looks like you can put in a cosmological constant here too to make the analogy even more transparent than you put with divide by g here, so you have 1 over g and so minus lambda equal to 0. This is sort of part of my talk anyway. I was supposed to talk about similarities to the g-bar.
Okay.
So here you see a general relativity is a quadratic term, and there's some potential that is played by the 3 curvature, 3 Ricci scalar curvature, and energy is played from the cosmological constant is playing a role of energy here. So of course, everything here is dependent. If you go strongly with a Hamiltonian formulation, then this theory becomes very interesting because you see all these kinds of similarities. And within that Hamiltonian formulation, you see that this theory is not like general relativity. There's an important consequence of reparametrization invariance here. I won't go through the argument here, but it's very easy to convince yourself that a lambda here cannot have any operational significance. The easiest way to see that is just assume the opposite. Suppose this represents some reading of some physical clock, this lambda here. So it would be something like a Newtonian time or something like that. Then you get into a contradiction. In fact, the theory cannot make unique empirical predictions if you make that assumption. So there's an important consequence here already because of differentiation varieties. This lambda here cannot play the role or cannot be interpreted as representing an external system like a clock. Because then the theory becomes very, well, you don't get unique empirical predictions and so on. So, lambda cannot by that slogan, I just mean, if you compare the Newtonian theory, this symbol T here, sort of the high school interpretation of it is that we have a clock, the capital, right? And that T is just the clock we're reading. But that interpretation doesn't hold, or it can be. It's not a good one in Jacobi's theory. And it's not a good one here either. It's, you interpret lambda as an operationally well-defined symbol, it's not good either. But there's no problem in interpreting T, the dynamic variable here, as operationally well-defined. Yes. So, so if you look at the equations of motion here, of course, it's defined the T by square T by T. Lambda, if you introduce a special parameterization, so this is recovery of Newtonian mechanics. So if you have a special, what we just call T here now, defined in this way, and this equation here reduces just to dt mk e dt. And this is just Newton's equations of motion. Just put it aside here now. But when we put, so if you put lambda is equal to t here, we also say that t over e minus v is equal to 1. And if that's 1, that means that t plus e, t plus v is equal to e. So we don't get all of Newtonian mechanics, just the part which has a certain fixed energy.
I don't understand the difference. Energy is fixed in Newtonian mechanics.
Yes, so it's a solid difference. The difference is the following. In this theory, energy comes out as an integration constant. In Jacobi's theory, it comes out as a fundamental constant of nature, like mass or whatever. So it is a subtle difference, but it's... Now we go to the Hamiltonian formulation. One can also say, just a comment here, I won't go into this, T might potentially serve this expression here might potentially serve as an operational definition of time. Time would just be defined in this way. Well, let me make an extended comment here. If you define time in this way, you would have a trajectory like that, and you have to insert your trajectory of lambda here and so on, and all these expressions. Then time is actually an integrated quantity along a trajectory. So if everything just stood still here now, no motion, right? Then the time doesn't flow at all. So this theory completely implements the idea that time is a measure of change. and nothing else. If everything stands still, no time is flowing. One can contrast this to the notion of time in parameterized quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics of an extended computation space. Here it has nothing to do with histories at all. If you pick a point here in this space, suppose this is here, a space direction, I can just read off what time it is. I'll get the value of time there. So time is a property of a configuration space point here, but in this theory it's a property of a history. Let's go to the canonical mantle. Pk, of course, defined as dl, Jacobi. I'm just going to use an L here. Dx credit prime plus mk k prime. Here's an interesting thing. This contains a square of those things, and it's a square root. So, an interesting. So, let me define this symbol, big P as just P1, Pn here. And because of these probability ratios, it is the case that P of C, big X here, C, X prime. That's equal to x and x prime. So it doesn't matter what magnitude the x variable has or the velocity, you always get the same amount of momentum. Which means that this mapping from velocity space, velocity phase space to phase space, is not one to one, it's many to one. So, and already here we sort of see this is a constrained dynamic system. We have, so this is velocity space. And a mapping from this space to phase space is many to one. So all these guys get just mapped to one point there. And this means that we know there's going to be constraints among them. Canonical variables. We have a standard example of the constraint dynamic system. Let me just come here first. There's another surprise. The canonical Hamiltonian is defined by Ek is k prime times L. But if you do the calculation here, this is identically zero. And what I mean here is that when you solve, so you can try to solve for E in terms of X, X prime instead of P here. If you insert that, everything is identically to the zero. It's not that this function is constrained to zero. No, the function itself is identically zero. So we don't have a canonical Hamiltonian in this state. This always happens when you have recompensation invariants. You can toy around with this condition. You see that it always leads had canonical Hamiltonian from the zero. And number two, this is important now. We have a constraint in theory. If you take this canonical momentum now, and I'm going to write now the expression. First you square the dk, and you divide by 2mk, and sum over it. And add the potential minus E. Then this is zero. Here's the difference with that here. This is not zero as a function, it's a constrained to be zero. Because when we're going from the velocity phase space to phase space here, we're getting to, because this many to one mapping here, we're going to get to sub manifolds here. And this constraint here is the thing that I think holds this constraint surface we have to be on. So, and it's this constraint that sort of saves the day here, because in presence of constraints, we have to add all our constraints like that. This was zero, of course, so this is just equal to, I should also write here, this here's a Lagrangian multiplier, just an arbitrary thing here. That's equal to zero. We can add a free term Lagrangian multiplier times the constraint here. And this is the most general expression for Hamiltonian. This is allowed to be a phase space function. So it's this total Hamiltonian that's going to govern our dynamics. It's n. Here we arrive at this form of the Hamiltonian constraint. So Hamiltonian is the one with the Lagrangian multiplier, and the Hamiltonian constraint would be this thing. And it's quadratic. There is one curious difference between this Hamiltonian constraint and the one we have in general relativity. This one is positive. Sorry, what's the constraint? Here's the constraint. This is a positive quadratic, positive definite quadratic form here. There's no negative signs, so this is sort of an elliptic constraint. In general relativity, though, because this guy here is actually a signature minus, plus, 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 another one. So this is actually a hyperbolic constraint. And that might be a very important difference. It might be that when you're saying, oh, Jacobi's theory is so similar to general relativity, this difference between this being a hyperbolic constraint and an elliptic constraint, that could make a whole lot of difference. Well, that should be careful here, I think. Take the equations of motion, you get now again, we see here, if you just put this n is equal to 1, we just get the back order and the equations of motion. So, and the difference is, of course, that in addition to these equations, we also have the constraint which should be imposed. So this theory is very interesting for another reason. It is generally held within constraint dynamics community that all first class constraints generate gauge transformations. This theory is a straightforward counterexample to that. So This is also another interesting feature here, which might be relevant for how you really quantize such a theory. So Julie Barber and Randall Foster put out a paper regarding this issue. I can just say a little bit about this.
This is a counterexample to some folklore or to the proper theorem?
It's believed to be a proper theorem.
But it's not.
It's also related to something called Dirac's conjecture. But it's generally believed that all first class constraints generate gauge transformation. So the definition of a first class constraint is that it commutes with all other constraints. The Poisson bracket with all other constraints are zero. But this is trivial here because this guy is the only constraint here. It's trivially gauge theory in this respect. So the definition that whenever you have first class constraints in the theory, you call it the gauge theory. And you say that this is related to that. You'll have a transformation that doesn't change the physical state, but change the mathematical representation of it. Now, if you look at a gauge transformation here, so I'm putting it in brackets here now. If you look at the gauge transformation, if you take your xk here now, and you make your gauge transformation here in quotation marks. The way you always do it is adding the Poisson bracket, xk. At least you may compute to be equal to xk plus epsilon and xk prime over mk. This constraint acts on our phase space. It does not act on projectors or anything like that. It acts on points here. And what it does do is taking one point, which if you just look at the projection down to configuration space here, it might be, I don't know an example I should have. Maybe it represents particle in the box and all particle up in the left upper corner. And then you do a gauge transformation. You follow the gauge orbits here. And notice that these gauge orbits are exactly the one which is the evolution equation as well. You get to a new point. And that new point might be all particles down in the down rightmost corner. So here we have an immediate problem. If you now believe the general folklore that this is just a gauge transformation, we have to say that this situation is physically the same as that. Of course, that's possible. You can say that, okay, our interpretation of the theory is wrong. These x's here cannot be interpreted as point particles in physical space. Please provide a different interpretation. But this is what is problematic here. How are you supposed to understand this theory? What are these x's here? What do they represent? So there's a much easier answer here. This is not the gauge transformation at all. And this is very much related. If you go through Dirac's argument with the gauge transformations. Let me take a picture here. This is the standard argument that you have some configuration space and you have an operationally well-defined symbol T here. And then you start some initial condition and you can get two different evolutions here. And then you look at them at a similar moment of time. And then you say, oh shit, I can have two different physical systems, unless these are physically equivalent, which is two different mathematical representations of the same physical situation.
here there's a heavy use of this symbol here. We didn't take the plane like that or like that. We take the plane as at constant t. If you compare that this now to Jacobi's theory, where you would have x and b here, and a lambda which doesn't have any operational meaning, cannot be thought of representing an external clock, then this is more like the situation here. Here's the trajectory of phase space. And here are different parameterizations of it. This is how it will look like. So this is sort of just, you see this, what this, looks like, what this picture represents? Here's the projection down to phase space. And this is just merely two different representations of that trajectory. Now, of course, we could run the same argument saying here that, well, look here, I just cut through a plane here, and I should compare configuration at the same moment of time, lambda, like that. So that point should be compared with that point here. They say, oh, shit, they're different. Therefore, they should be thought of as two different gauges representing the same physical system. But now in this theory, there's nothing sacred about different parameterizations. Why do you think you can compare these two points? Why didn't you compare those two points instead? That's a different way of doing it. Now, if you do that, of course, you have exactly the same values of t's and q's here. You just make a different correspondence. So this is sort of the way out here. So let me quickly quantize this theory, and then we're going to get into the De Broglie bone stuff. So this is very important, I think, because according to Dirac, if we have things that generate gauge transformations, we should quantize things, and you get operating constraints, and you should impose that as conditions on the quantum states. Why should you follow these rules if your constraint is not the gauge, doesn't generate gauge transformations? I think this is a very important foundational question here.
Well, are you going to tell us the application to gravity, or are you just making a comment? I mean, are you suggesting not to impose the Hamiltonian constraint or something along those lines?
To me, this is not clear at all what this really means. To me, it's a bit a pity that most people in quantum gravity haven't looked at this theory, because when you look at it, it's just staring in your face. This is some gauge transformations. In general, it's different. It's harder to see because you have also foliation invariant and so on. That makes things much more intricate. But at least this is just a counterexample. These are not gauge transformations in this theory. You cannot generally believe in this folklore that all first-class constraints generate gauge transformations. So quantization.
Well, no, but these are equations of motion.
What?
They are equations of motion. So if they were, I mean, this chi equals zero is an equation of motion.
Yeah, this one here?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you have to impose that.
If it didn't follow, you'd have to impose it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, even if you don't use that other argument, there's another, even if you don't use the argument that it's a.
Again,
therefore we should impose it
to
be zero, and you have another reason to impose it, which is the classical limit, right?
That might be. So to me, how do you, so quantization, you just put operators on things. So this is just defined as multiplication by xk, so we're working in configuration space. Pk goes to operator dk hat minus I delta k, like that. And you have the usual computation relation. Now, first, from this perspective, you make this note here that you shouldn't really quantize in the usual way. I don't know, but let's just stick to the ordinary quantization procedure now. I just want to put the question mark here.
So if you do it in a standard way, you put operators like that and you get xp is equal to pi, that thing, and your constraint goes into the operator constraint. And ordinary quantization tells you that you should impose. You should impose that constraint, operator constraint, as a condition on a state. But that also just gives you. This condition here. So this is just a time-independent Schrödinger equation, or the energy eigenstate equation. Look at again the similarity here. So this is an interesting idea, also which very little work has been done on. So in general relativity, you have this type of constraint, 1/g. I think I wrote it. So everybody's interested in values of the cosmological constant, right? What are the potential values here? Why is it so small, etc.? Well, of course, here energy gets quantized and can only attain different discrete eigenvalues. And the same should apply over here as well. So to be more precise here, if you say that psi should belong to an L square, square degree of wave functions on configuration space, then we know that this spectrum becomes discretized and you get sort of predictions of what kind of energies of the whole universe you can have. And in the same way, this equation here, which would turn into an operator constraint, bit like that, and similarly, if you compose some very, very mathematically defined square integral wave functions or wave functions on the superspace, you see that big thing becomes quantized. So this theory tells you that not all energy values are allowed in this theory. If you would take this thing here, the V, for example, is that -1/r, something like that. This is your potential. You get these different energies here, which accumulate near the zero. And if you say, if you believed in the beginning that your E was here, and you also claim that the wave functions are members of the square integral Hilbert space, then there is no solution to this equation whatsoever. So this is also one question people are posing. Are there any solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation? And indeed, here you see that it might not have any solutions for specific E's. In the same way, that might have zero solutions for specific lambdas. There's also a continuous part of the spectra here where for any E, you have solutions. But those strictly don't lie in this Hilbert space. And you have to go to the ring Hilbert space and so on. But that's the case. How do you develop the Brillouin theory? We do the standard trick. We introduce the polar decomposition of the wave function. We just plug it in to this equation here. So this is my triangle equation. Put that into that equation. Then you get two distinct equations. these are the two equations you get. To get a guidance equation, it's a bit strange. I don't fully understand everything in the detail of why it so happens. First of all, we will insist that, as usual, with ordinary Hampton Jacobi theory, that E is physically the gradient of the phase. So that seems to be always valid in the known field. What happens next is that we really need some kind of guidance equation, right? To tell how x prime is moving.
It's just a definition, isn't it? I mean, is it always valid?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a definition.
You think it's as a definition too. I have to think more about that. But you like a guidance equation. And just saying that, exactly what you're saying, it's just a definition. Okay, you have an x here, right? X. But it didn't tell you anything about the velocity of the time. Now, you have to look at things that relate to x prime to p. But the obvious one is the canonical momentum. And it doesn't work. You just get contradiction. So this is known before it happens when sort of your system is not an ordinary quadratic, you know, it doesn't have this problem in Newtonian, it's just Newtonian form. Oh, it's here. It doesn't have this form. Then you square it. So, and this is sort of curious, but the equation you should use, because then everything works, is Hamilton's first equation. So, the one you use here is use that just a thing, so that normally you consider it does not contain so much dynamics, it's really the second equation. If you use this equation together, well, so this thing just gives you, doesn't work, but this thing works. You get your guidance equation, which is representation invariant, and everything is nice. You just plug it in and just use that relation and that relation. So this is your guiding equation here.
When you say it doesn't work, you mean it gives the wrong answer or it gives no answer?
It tells, well, there's this cube here. It works if and only if the quantum potential of this expression is zero. And then you can read off. In fact, if you just take the thing you get here from here, the relation between x prime and p you get from here, and plug it in this equation, you can prove that q is zero. And that doesn't make sense. So
it gives you a different guidance equation.
Yeah,
not the one you want, doesn't reserve.
Yeah, so for most wave functions it's inconsistent. Only for those wave functions where q is identically equal to zero does it work.
What does it mean to call it inconsistent?
Just that q, you can calculate q from your wave function and it's not zero. But then if you use this equation, I did right now, and just plug it in here, this equation, it has to be zero. So that's a contradiction.
Hans, what kind of interpretation has the wave function in this case? Because okay, in the normal Schrodinger equation, it tells you like at a given time have this probability of obtaining this result. In this formulation, you can only compare situations internal to the system, like when this variable at this value, it's because this variable other variable has these other values. And in this case, what kind of probability, a sort of conditional probability?
Okay, so let me just sketch it. This is sort of needs to be thought about more, obviously, but this is one suggestion. So the first thing is that this is on configuration space. You have a static object, psi,
doesn't evolve, and that generates a velocity field. The one role of psi is to define a velocity field for you. Second, you can say, well, maybe so you can compare it with Hamiltonian mechanics in phase space, where you have an age that also generates, and that age is generally static, that also generates a sort of a loss of velocity field. And you get, of course, vectors. One natural assumption is that if I would, for example, start in this region, I don't know exactly in this region I start. It's consistent with me preparing some system. Knobs are in these settings and so on. And knobs has to be in the theory, in this theory. It has to be, you have to model everything. And then you would ask the probability for you to get into two distinct regions in configuration space. Outcome variables representing plus, outcome variables representing minus. And then one assumption here is just, but first of all, the fundamental thing to do here, is, or the basic thing is to do is, you take your ensemble here, and you say, well, suppose these are distributed according to psi squared. That would be one way to think about it. The question is, I mean, this might be empirically incorrect also. But this would be what comes immediate to mind here in both here. So this depends on x. And then I would simply take and integrate all these ones here, and I would just count how many of these guys ends up here, and these guys end up here. So I can partition this one here with the ones that goes and ends up here, and the ones that ends up over here. And I just integrate, I look at the measure here. And I say that's my empirical prediction. So that's but of course now I'm using trajectories here, and it's not clear how you would think about it in ordinary quantum theory. That's presumably different than if you look at these measures here. If you compare that measure to that measure, that measure to that measure, those might not be the same.
What do you mean? How would you think of it in ordinary quantum theory? You don't even have the configuration space in ordinary quantum theory.
I don't even have the ordinary.
I mean, you don't have this configuration space for which the psi is a velocity field in ordinary quantum theory. If you mean by ordinary quantum
theory? So of course, here we're in a timeless theory. But this is, I mean, half of the Royal Gnome theory is always ordinary quantum theory, right? There is a wave function on configuration space. So here I'm a bit unclear how to think about things and if it really makes sense and so on. So we're getting soon to. I have 1 minute to finish. So let me. One of the reasons why I'm interested here, I really would like to see if this Wheeler-DeWitt equation of quantum gravity actually makes sense. First, at naive level, it looks strange. It's an equation. It's not an ordinary Schrodinger equation. There's no unitary evolution or anything like that. There's no time. So naively, it looks like it doesn't make sense. Here, if you look at, of course, that could just be a lack of imagination. If you had the right trick, you can actually make it work. What we've done here is sort of get a different or an equivalent problem of time in a simple theory. We have much more, it's much easier for us to investigate the issue here whether or not the Wheeler-DeWitt equation makes sense. So, where's my Wheeler-DeWitt equation? If you put psi on here, it might be that this is just this equation here. This is just nonsensical. It can never be compatible with empirical facts.
you look at the energy spectra, and this is a key element here to see that, at least in some cases, this doesn't work at all. If you assume the energy spectrum is non-degenerate, so if H psi 1 is equal to E psi 1 and H psi 2 is equal to E psi 2 like that. So this is what we mean by non-degenerate spectrum, right? Then psi 1 is equal to psi 2. But if that's the case, then the most general solution to our equation like that is psi is equal to some constant phase, the 0 to emphasize it's actually a constant, and just some real function. This is a member. It's just a F is just a function from R of Vn into the reals. But in particular, then we see that phase is a constant, and our de Broglie-Bohm equations just gives you zero. Then we have a real problem of time here, because we have a point which just stands still. Now, I can sketch, so if that happens, everything is screwed. There's a way so if you go to the general case.
I don't understand the problem.
Yeah?
You just have a fixed particle.
Yes, so I have a particle. So in the Broglie-Bohm theory, so I'm probably too quick here because I'm running out of time. In the Broglie-Bohm theory, right? Take quantum theory first, you just have a static wave function. It's hard to think, it's not really hard to think about that. In the Broglie-Bohm theory, you have a trajectory, and things are not different than classical mechanics. Or in Jacobi's time mechanics, you don't have an external absolute time, you just have a trajectory, but that's okay. But now, if your spectrum is non-degenerate, there's no solution which is degenerate. And you always get so for all energies you just have this type of solution. Then this guiding equation, which could be wrong of course, but this is I can't play too much with the rules, right? Then it just stands still. The velocity is identically zero everywhere on the configuration space for all such wave functions. And that's a severe problem. Mm-hmm.
You cannot have superposition of different energy states?
Exactly, that's what this states, right? So this comes out as a constraint in theory, that you have to work with this energy and no other theory, which is very different from ordinary quantum mechanics, because when you can work with all different kinds of energies, and you superpose them with this I to the E, T in there, right? And that's how time comes in. In the degenerate case, you can have non-trivial dynamics, and potentially everything is fine. So just to end things here, so. So still it's the case that we know at least for some system in the universe, we have an evolving wave function. You have to recover all that formalism if there's any truth to this. So how could you do it here? So you have one fundamental wave function of what I'm going to put the BQ here as my B configuration. And I'm going to consider a system and an environment. So this is sort of many particles now. You sort of have a point particle here, and then other particles. It should be the case that if this particle is sufficiently isolated from those, you have a boundary bond mechanics coming out somehow. The only reasonable candidate for the conditional wave function here, or a wave function for a subsystem, is one that looks like this, psi, and then you plug in. Let me put the t here. So let me fix n equals to 1 in Gaussian theory to put the t there. This is the only reasonable definition of a wave function of a subsystem. You cannot take the reduced density matrix because that's also static. So this is the only time-dependent quantity I can really have here. There's no other really natural definition. And of course, I need to normalize this. Square root d3x psi of x dx. And I can also think that I can attach a phase like that because the wave function is only projectively defined. So under the right circumstances, this wave function here should behave as a ordinary wave function, subject to unitary evolution or Schrodinger equation. So I should really finish now. So what you can do here is just write down a necessary and sufficient condition. If you use the de Broglie-Bohm trajectories, I can just write them down. You'd like that this guy here, sorry, the upper end after that, like that this guy should satisfy something like this. This is a potential just for this particle, V of x, and I represents an interaction potential here. I don't know, maybe it's not so interesting to write down the necessary sufficient conditions. But what you can do, since this guy is defined in terms of the big wave function, you can get an extra condition on big psi. That you always have a Schrodinger equation for the subsystem. So, and this is, I believe this will fail. But because now, here you have something which you really can investigate now. Everything is clean, everything is just ordinary long-term quantum mechanics. The reason I think it will fail is that because if you allow some arbitrary So some kind of weak interaction between the system and the environment here, that will break the general spectra. In general, for most I, you'll break it. When you break it, you get this thing that you have no evolution here, and this guy has been zero too. So, and you can also see easily here that. If there's no entanglement between the system and the environment, again, this conditional wave function will not evolve in an interesting way. Only evolution will be in the phase. So these are cases where the whole problem fails. I think I stop here. I was 10 minutes over, 10 minutes past.
So the only difference between time-based mechanics, well, quantizing, well, de Broglie the Broglie-Bohr quantization of timeless mechanics and the Broglie-Bohr quantization of ordinary mechanics is that one has energy built into the Hamiltonian,
yeah.
The other doesn't.
Yes. Yeah. So this is, I mean, you made the comment, right, that in Newtonian theory it's an integration constant energy, but in this theory it's built into the Lagrangian. And this is how it plays out in the end.
So that's
but
the problem.
That's the problem. Yeah. And you can also think that in general relativity, what you should have had was a theory that allows you superpositions of different cosmological constants. And then you would have a non-trivial time evolution. In fact, you can even write down a new action inspired by Jacobi's theory. This would be a new action in general relativity. You would have this two here. You would have the kinetic term, which would be look like this, d to the x, g I j k l, and here's basically the kinetic, the velocities, and then you would have cosmological. The equivalent of Jacobi's theory, the complete equivalent, would look like this. Like that. And in this theory, lambda would not be an integration constant. But in this theory, you can go back to the theory, like Newtonian mechanics, where this would be an integration constant. This would not be unimodular gravity, but something different.
Would this be covariant?
It won't be covariant. That's the thing, and there's no way to do that. I think. So this is an extremely non-local action as well. If you choose special parameterization, time parameterization, everything is local again. And this is also a theory. It contains an absolute time, and it also contains 1 degree more freedom than ordinary general relativity. So it's not clear what. But I wanted to comment here. From this theory, you can go backwards. So you can get to a theory with no cosmological constant, but the cosmological constant would be an integration constant, and the action would look like e to the x. Here you have the kinetic term like that, and minus. Or is it plus the curvature? It would just look something very simple like that, and times the square root of g. And this theory would contain 1 degree more freedom than the general relativity, so that could just mean that it's incorrect.
So it's not general relativity, it's something else.
It's something else. Maybe that dark matter, you know. or maybe you should say, well, let's introduce some scaling variance. Get it. If that's possible. But that's sort of where if one wants to modify general relativity, so you don't get this Hamiltonian constraint with a fixed cosmological constant, this is sort of where you should go. But then it seems either you go to this unimodular gravity, where time is sort of space-time volume.
So what's wrong with that one in your view?
Unimodular gravity, but it's not easy how to write down. Well, maybe it is easy to do with a pattern though. But in sort of an economical framework, it would be hard to work with.
People have written down, you introduced some auxiliary fields.
Can you be more specific?
Yeah, I think you introduced, for example, a vector density, and its divergence represents the root minus g as an equation of motion. And then its integral over a surface represents part volume to the crest of that surface.
And you would introduce a preferred.
And then you write down the Lagrangian for that. No, there's nothing preferred.
So this vector field was.
You introduce probably a Lagrange multiplier type field, times you get to that turns into the cosmological constant.
Yeah. So probably then, yeah, at least the preferred velocity field then, which is this vector field, because you can always straighten every vector field out, right? And this is sort of completely equivalent to theory where you would have a preferred state of rest.
Well, if it has a vector field in the theory, yes. I don't know what's. I mean, it's a covariant. It's a completely covariant theory. I mean, you do introduce auxiliary fields.
Sean, have a question.
Oh,
the chairman has to run, so.
Yeah.
Chair yourself.
Thank you.